and streamed past him after the enemy. Vali shouted at them to halt. About 20 Danes had gone off on a flanking movement, and he felt sure they were about to attack from the rear. But there was no hope of controlling his men, who sprinted after the Danes, followed down the lane by most of the women and many of the children, waving sticks and house knives as they ran. Pushing back through them, Vali then ran to the end of the lane and stared down into the valley behind the hill. No Danes. Instinctively, he looked over to Deesa's farm. A pall of smoke hung over it. He gave a shiver. Had Deesa been able to run with her burned legs? Had Adisla managed to get her away? Her daughter would not have abandoned her, he knew that. He glanced around for help, but the only warrior near him was Bjarki, still barely conscious, tied up to the point of strangulation with a couple of small children hitting him with sticks. Vali shooed them away from the berserk, all the time looking around for any of his men who had remained.
"Bragi! With me!" he shouted, as loud as he could.
But Bragi was gone, down to the Danes' boats, planning to take them out to sea and deny the attackers their escape. Vali was on his own. Dread swamped his exhaustion, and he ran towards the burning farm faster than he had ever run in his life. Chapter 19 Endings. Drengi had arrived in time to at least face the invaders. He was a farmer, not a fighter, though, and he was lying by a feed trough with his own axe embedded in his chest. The old Dane Barth had been shown no mercy by his countrymen and was slumped next to him as if dozing in the sun. Little Manni was dead at the doorway of Deesa's house, Vali's old seax still in his hand. Vali closed his eyes and tried to compose himself. He had no time for mourning. He needed to find what had happened to Adisla and her mother. He ran into the smouldering building. The Danes had tried to set it alight, but the turf roof would not burn well, and the smoke looked more like that from a dung heap than a fire. Deesa had been murdered in her bed. Blood was everywhere, a grisly scarf of red extending down the front of her white smock. He approached and saw that her throat was cut. He could imagine all too well what else had happened to her. Vali knelt beside her and took her hand. She had been his mother, or the nearest he had to one. He said nothing. So far that day he had learned what it was to believe in a fight and take up arms in a cause that was beyond plunder. Looking into Deesa's eyes, it seemed impossible that he would ever do anything else. He did not cry, which surprised him. There was something inside him too cold for tears. It was a certainty that seemed to lodge in his throat like a bolus, stopping up any emotion. He would have vengeance for this. Adisla told him to kill 100 of them. He wouldn't stop there. He would kill the Danish king and all his stinking race, tear down his halls and burn his lands to ashes. The Danes had unleashed a wolf by what they had done. He had never known such purpose in all his life. But first, he had something else to do. He went to the top of the bed and kissed Deesa on the forehead. "I will find her," he said, and then left the house. As he did so, he passed the boy's body. He ruffled his hair and kissed him. He went to take the seax, but thought better of it. Instead, he just squeezed the child's fingers onto the weapon's handle. "You keep it," he said. "Use it in the afterlife. Go to Freya's halls, not Odin's." Vali heard a groan. He looked up. Drengi was still alive. He ran over to the fallen man. "Drengi, it's me, Vali." Drengi was just about breathing,
The axe had caused a terrible wound in his chest, and his mouth bubbled with blood. Vali didn't know what to do. Disa or Yodis might have known, but one was dead and the other who knows where.
Drengi, you'll live. I've seen men with worse wounds survive. You will live.
This was not true, and they both knew it.
They came for her, Vali. They came for her.
I know.
No, they came for her. No treasure, no plunder. Her.
He let out an awful cough, fighting to suck in breath. Vali's mind was too disordered to take in what Drengi was saying.
You'll be fine, Drengi. I'll fetch my Yodis and she'll patch you up. You see, you'll be fine.
Vali, they were looking for her. They asked for the healer's daughter.
Vali couldn't understand why that would be at all.
Asked who?
They had taken the boy, Loptr, prisoner. He led them here and told them who to look for. They were shouting her name.
He coughed and blood flowed over his lips. Is the boy dead too?
No. He ran away.
Remove the axe, Vali. Take the axe away.
It is a blight to me.
Yes. Vali put two hands to the shaft near the head. He pulled, and Drengi screamed. He pulled again, and the axe came free. Drengi coughed and spluttered, hacked and wheezed. Then he was quiet. Vali took his hand. He was dead. Vali became aware he was being watched. He looked up to see Loptr peering out from behind a pig shelter.
You can come out now, child. They've gone, said Vali.
The boy didn't move. He looked very scared.
Did they take her? Did they take Adisla?
The boy nodded.
Which way?
The child pointed at the track heading south out of the farmstead that led to several broad beaches. If the Danes had got their ships away from the harbour, they might pick up stragglers there.
Go back down to the harbour, said Vali. If you encounter any of our warriors, tell them I've gone down to Selstrond to find these pirates, and tell them to come and help me. Quick, go on!
The boy didn't move, just stared at him. It was no use, Vali decided. Loptr was too shocked by what he'd seen to do anything.
Well, don't go into Mardisa's house, said Vali, and he set off for the beach.
When he arrived, the shoe told him all he needed to know. It was where the track petered out in the sand, just at the point that anyone coming onto the beach would find it. It was hers, one of the green leather best she had been wearing to greet him back from his journey. Clearly she had kicked it off. He was only just too late. The longship was close offshore. He couldn't see Adisla, but there were around 20 warriors visible on the boat. Still, he didn't really absorb Drengi's words. Vali, they were looking for her. His brain was hot with hatred, and he didn't even recall what Drengi had said.
Come back, you cowards! He screamed. I am one, and you are 20! Are the odds not enough in your favour?
There was no reply from the ship. The Danes were too busy with their sail. But then, for a heartbeat, he saw her, struggling to dive overboard and swim to freedom. She was pulled roughly back onto the boat.
I'll find you, he screamed as he splashed out into the water. And know, Danes, that if she is harmed, I'll visit 1,000 times worse on you and your kinsmen. I am Vali, son of Orthon. I am death to you.
Vali felt utterly hopeless. There was no prospect of pursuit. Forkbeard's longships were away down the coast at the regional assembly. All they had were a few fairings, four oared inshore boats, and he couldn't chase a warship in one of those. How would he find her? He'd try Heithabir, he thought, the market where any slave brought to Denmark ended up. He could buy her if he could raise the money from his father or borrow it from Forkbeard. Then he remembered he had the berserk. He would get what he wanted to know out of him. He turned back towards the site of the battle. When he found Bjarki, he was in no fit state to answer questions. The drugs, drink, and the bang on the head had rendered him almost insensible. All he could do was curse and drool. He was safe for the time being, but Vali wondered how long he would last if any of the townspeople got hold of him. Preserving the berserk's life was his only key to finding Adisla. The man was too big to drag anywhere without help. Luckily, up the hill at that moment came Bragi with two farmers, Gudfastr and Baugr, Loptr beside them. So he had done his job after all.
"How does it go?" said Vali. "They're routed. One ship captured. A good day's work."
Bragi didn't look quite as jubilant as Vali might have expected.
"They've taken Adisla. Mardisa's dead, and the rest of them at the house, from what I can tell."
Bragi's mouth fell open.
"Anyone else?"
"I don't know. They were quick, so I think it unlikely."
"They didn't take him, did they?"
He nodded to the boy, who was still looking at Vali with wide, terrified eyes.
"They were being quick, for sure, or they wouldn't have left the boy. He'd have got a good price at market." "You'll want vengeance, won't you, Loptr?" said Bragi.
The boy said nothing, just withdrew behind Baugr.
"Get that berserk down into the village," said Vali. "He's got some questions to answer. As soon as he recovers, let me know. Tell the people that by my command there will be no celebration until Forkbeard returns. Make them keep a watch. Two Drakars escaped, and may well return if they think we imagine the danger is past."
He turned away down the hill, towards the valley.
"Where are you going?" said Bragi.
"To see my Yodis,"
said Vali. Chapter 20. A Hard Road Forward.
"Ma, it's me. Ma?"
Yodis's house was much smaller than Deesa's. Not much more than a hut sunk into the earth, its walls just waist high. With its flat turf roof, you could hardly see it until you were right on it. Vali knocked at the door.
"Ma, it's me, Vali. Ma, it's all right, they've gone."
The door opened, and Yodis peered out. She was trembling, though trying not to show it.
"How many dead?"
"I don't know. It could have been worse. We beat them." "They've gone, Ma."
Yodis wiped the tears from her eyes.
"Adisla? Mardisa?"
"That's why I'm here," he said.
"Oh, Freya, guard them,"
said Yodis, who had guessed no good had come to the women.
"What?"
"Mardisa is dead, and Adisla taken," said Vali.
Yodis could no longer hold on to her tears.
"I'll avenge the first and find the second," said Vali. She gave him that look again, the one she'd given him when she'd heard that Forkbeard had planned to hang Adisla, but then she tempered it. She was very fond of Vali, but regarded him as something of an idiot. The capture of the wolfman had shown that he wasn't.
"Do you even know where they've gone, or who they were?"
"I suspect they'll go to Heithabir, at least eventually. They were Danes, Harik and his men."
"They could take her to his court, or sell her in the east, or do many other things with her. She could be anywhere."
"Which is why I'm here," said Vali.
Yodis looked blankly at him.
I want you to work Mardisa's magic. It took me to the Wolfman. It can take me to her.
She shook her head.
Oh, I've never done it. Mardisa had a gift for that. I just helped her.
Then you know how it's done.
Yes, but it's not possible even if I wanted to. The fire herbs are all gone. They grow only in the spring, and they're very rare. We won't be able to harvest any for months.
Those herbs are entirely necessary.
Yes.
Raleigh breathed out heavily. He had no faith at all that the berserk would yield information under torture, though that wouldn't stop him trying.
Did the berserk know anything anyway? He was a hired hand.
Raleigh knew that when Forkbeard went on raids with berserks, he kept the target secret until they were at sea, to prevent them going it alone. As much as it would please him to try to beat information out of Bjarki, Raleigh doubted he actually had any.
There is no other way?
Yodis shrugged.
What?
Said Raleigh.
There is, but it'll kill you.
What is it?
You go to Odin at the Maya,
said Yodis.
Meaning?
It's not been done since I was a girl. But if the prophecy is important enough to you, then it's worth it. You go to Grimnir's Mire and present yourself to the god of the hanged, the god of the drowned, and you ask him what you want to know.
How do I do this?
By drowning,
said my Yodis.
How can the prophecy be any good to me if I die?
You go to the edge of death, and there you bargain with the gods for your life. You offer them what you can, and if it pleases them, they take it and tell you what you need to know.
What can I offer a god?
Your suffering, she said.
Vali stiffened his jaw and gave a short nod. Have you done this?
No. But I have seen it done. It was many years ago now. Princess Heithr went to the Maya.
I thought that was just a story. Was it a success?
She revealed 4 traitors in her father's court, and the location of the Thjalfi hoard.
They found the hoard?
They did. Though she never got to see it. The ordeal killed her.
Vali put his hand on the low roof and thought for a moment. What was his life without Adisla, anyway? Everyone has to die, it's just a matter of when. Only a fool would throw his life away, though.
Can you do it? I don't want to die for nothing, Ma.
It's straightforward, but more a question of whether you can do it. You drown at the sacred mire. The place between land and water. It's a gateway that leads to other places in the 9 worlds. The force of your will is all you'll have to help you find the path. You need no more preparation than a warrior dying in battle does to make it to Valhalla.
Raleigh gave a curt nod.
How long will it take?
Who knows? You must drown and revive, drown and revive, until the vision comes to you. Or you drown and do not revive. It could happen the first time. It could happen the 10th or never. And it's not easy to force yourself back to those waters, no matter how much you're burning for an answer. You'll fight it, so you'll need to be tied.
Vali had vowed to ask Odin for nothing, but his was a circumstance he had not foreseen.
I'll do it, said Vali.
There is one other thing, said Yodis. The gods aren't the only things waiting in the 9 worlds. We'll put a noose on you. It's a symbol so the god can find you. But if you snap your bonds or begin to speak as a giant or witch or worse, then we'll use it to kill you. Don't converse with giants, Vali, nor with the other monsters you may see down there.
"Bring your rope," said Vali. "If this is the only way, then this is the only way. You'll need men to help you in and out of the water.
"'Even in your bonds you'll need to be held down,' said Yildiz. "'And I haven't the strength to strangle you, "'or the sureness to shorten your suffering with a knife.'
"'Is your grandson in there?'
"'He is.'
"'Then send him to Hongni and Ori,' said Vali. "'Come on. We need to begin.'
Chapter 21 The Drowning Pool. He had been at the drowning pool before, of course. It was in a sunken hollow on a natural shelf in the low hills that led up from Yodis's farm. Prisoners and sacrifices had been sent to the gods in Grimnir's mire in years gone by, but no one had died there since the princess had sought her answer all those years before. The children knew its reputation, though, and it was said that the ghosts of long-dead kings and warriors haunted the waters at night. Vali felt a chill go through him as he sat waiting for Hongni and Ori. Was it the breeze cutting in from the sea, or was it some deeper feeling? How many had died there, and to what purpose? Did places such as the mire really carry an imprint of the deaths they had seen, or was it just childish memories that set his flesh creeping, the echoes of stories told to frighten and thrill the long winter nights away? He felt very cold. Clouds had rolled in off the sea, turning the sky to iron and spitting the air with rain. He wished he had brought his cloak with him, but then realized he was going to be a lot colder soon. And what did his discomfort matter? Did Adisla have a cloak to shelter her from the rain out on that boat? What was happening to her? He couldn't bring himself to think on that. For every discomfort or abuse she suffered, he vowed to himself, those who inflicted it on her would suffer 100 times worse. Until he met her again, he swore, no pain would daunt him. He had suffered as much as it is possible to suffer when he saw her on that longship.
Lord, a great victory!
A hand was on his shoulder. It was Hongni.
"'The Danes have taken flight,' said Ori, "'and the win is yours to claim.'
"'My glory must wait a while,' said Vali. "'I have another battle to fight.'
He nodded towards the water. It was just a pool, he told himself, something he would use for a purpose, like a plough or a sword. Hongni and Ori looked at the noose Yodis was tying, the symbol of Odin, the triple slip knot. If that's what you could call it. The dead lord's necklace only slipped one way. Once it was on, you took it off with a knife, or not at all. The men glanced at each other.
"'You are seeking answers from the gods,' said Ori.
"'I want to find where Adisla has gone. Do you have a better way?'
"'They'll take her to Harik's court.'
"'Maybe, and maybe not. They could sell her in Heithabir or in any market along the way. She could be given to a mercenary as payment. And besides—'
He didn't want to say it. The thought seemed too bizarre. He recalled that strange man in the four-cornered hat. What had he been doing there?
Drengi's words had sunk in, too.
"'They came for her. They were looking for her. They called her name,' said Vali.
"'Why?'
Vali shrugged. Whatever Adisla's fate, it was surely not to be a straightforward slave. He was beyond explanation. He just knew that he had very little time and no scope to make a mistake.
"'This is the best way,' said Vali.
Hongni nodded.
"'I performed this office for your father,' he said.
"'What?'
There is a place in the Iron Woods, 4 days from his hall. Like this, it's a pool of prophecy. Your father asked questions of it.
How?
In the same way that you will, he said.
He looked at the coil of rope.
Did he find answers? It was when his difficulties began in earnest, said Hongni.
When was this?
4 years ago. He hadn't been well for years, but
Hongni looked like he was too ashamed to finish his sentence.
"He never came back from the woods," said Ori.
"I don't understand," said Vali. "Your father lives alone in the Iron Woods," said Hongni. "He has taken up the life of a mystic." It began to rain harder, a sudden sea squall coming in over them as fast as a bird. "The people say that Odin speaks to him in the woods, that he is granting the king his power. Do the people say that? Or does my mother?" The two men did not reply. Things were worse than Vali had thought. If anyone suspected that Orthon had lost his mind, it would be a disaster for the Horder. The king had more enemies than any man alive. No time to think on that. Vali looked into the dark waters and stretched his neck forward, steeling himself. "Begin," said Vali. Yodis told Ori to bind Vali by his hands and feet, while she put the noose over his head. "Is this the way Lord Orthon went about it?" said Vali. Yodis seemed confident how to perform the ritual, but Vali's nervousness made him look for reassurance.
"He offered a dedication to Odin before he went in," said Ori.
Vali smiled. "Well then, since I'm bound, perhaps I should offer a dedication to a bound god. Lord Loki, who the gods tormented, guide me to the vision I need."
"You shouldn't invoke that fellow, Lord," said Ori.
"Is Odin any more reliable?"
"Nor him," said Ori. "Freyr for a fuck, Tyr for a fight, and Thor for a fuck, a fight, and the rain to wash you afterwards. You don't need any more gods than that."
"Odin is the god of kings," said Vali. "Isn't that what we're told?"
"And berserk madmen," said Ori. "Sorry, sir, but it's true. When I go into a scrap, I want to know my god's on my side, not likely to desert me if the fancy takes him. Odin is a treacherous god. It is in his nature. I respect Lord Odin, and his kings and lunatics, but I wouldn't call on him. Oh, the other one you mentioned."
Ori wound the rope around Vali's feet. "Loki is an enemy of the gods, not of people," said Vali. "When did you ever hear of him acting against men? He kills giants, he kills gods, but men he helps or leaves alone." Yodis spoke.
"This is Odin's ceremony. He's Lord of the Hanged, the god who gave his eye for wisdom in the waters of the well. If you want help, it's him you'll call for. If you don't know, you will when you're in there, believe me."
She put the noose over his neck. "I've sworn never to ask that god for anything," said Vali.
"You will ask, or you will die," said Yodis.
She adjusted the rope at his neck, almost like she would straighten her child's tunic before allowing him to go to market.
"Let's hope we don't need this. Stay away from dark things," she said. "Only speak to the god himself."
"How will I know the difference?" said Vali.
"I have no idea," said Yodis. "Magic is a puzzle, not a recipe. So Mardisa used to say."
Vali nodded. His hands and his feet were secure, and he couldn't even balance to stand. She finished adjusting the noose and kissed him on the forehead.
"Take him to the middle of the mire."
Hongni and Ori lifted him, but found him cumbersome to carry between them. In the end, Hongni put him over his shoulder and walked across the squelching ground and into the water, Ori in front of him to test the way. In the middle they stopped. Hongni let Vali slide down and supported the prince as he stood precariously. The water was freezing, and it came up to their belts. Vali shivered.
"Should I call for Odin?"
said Hongni. Yodis shook her head.
"The prince should call, You should save your breath. If he comes, you might need it to beg him to leave. Are you ready, Varley?
Yes.
Put him under, and hold him there until I tell you to bring him up, said Yodis. Ongni, hold him down. Ori, keep hold of the rope. And both of you, stand by with your knives. He is going to the gates of hell, and if something claims him there, it can't be allowed to live in this world. This is how the swamp monsters are born.
The three men glanced at each other. If you have to kill me, said Varley. I won't consider you kinslayers. Ma Yodis is a witness to that. Then sit down, Lord, said Hongni. The first time was the easiest. Varley just let his legs go soft and leaned back into the mire as if into the sea on a summer's day. He closed his eyes and did not see the dark waters close over him. The panic kept away for a few heartbeats. At first, it was as if he was not himself, but an observer. The danger of his situation was not clear, and he still thought he could just stand up. Then fear broke over him like a wave. He desperately needed air. He tried to stand, and when he couldn't, he tried to sit up. Someone had a boot on the center of his chest. He could hear distorted voices from the surface and had to resist the desire to cry out to them. He wriggled free of the foot, tried to get onto his knees, and then felt a push at his side. It turned him over. Someone was pulling at his hands. Then they were kneeling or sitting on him, he couldn't tell which. Hongni and Ori were doing what they had promised, helping him to stay below the water. He struggled to hold his breath. Dread overwhelmed him. He felt that he was drowning in fear as much as water. The bonds would not come off. The weight on his back and on his legs felt immense, almost part of him, as if he were some enormous giant too heavy to lift itself. He couldn't get the ropes off. He couldn't get free. Varley tried to remember that he had chosen to be here, that he wanted this, but it was no good. An instinct, animal and undeniable, rose up in him, and he fought for the surface. He opened his eyes to look for the light, and could see no more in the muddy waters than when they were closed. Then his will burst, and he breathed in. He spat and coughed, and then felt his throat clench shut. He had the desire to move his body, but he could no longer do so, though he was kicking with his mind. His longing for the air seemed like something trapped in his head, thumping to get free. Still he struggled, the panic swamping even the emotions of despair. Then, as suddenly as it had come on, the terror was gone, and he felt peaceful, as if any cares he had, any frustrations and fears, were just silly things, almost incomprehensible under the calm that came down on him like a parent's kiss on a sleepy child. Light. And noise, hard blows, and a sensation of movement. The grass felt cold. Someone was slapping him across the back of the head. He tried to defend himself, but his hands were tied. A face came into focus. It was Yodis.
Nothing, she said.
Varley coughed, spluttering out water and mucus from his nose and mouth.
Nothing.
Do you need a rest?
Varley thought of Adisla, of what she would be enduring on the Danes' Drakkar.
No rest, he said.
He could hardly get the words out. His throat was dry and sore from where it had constricted in the water, and his muscles writhed on his bones in a deep shiver.
Put him back, said Yodis.
Time became flexible to Varley, a malleable thing, like a piece of hide to be stretched or shrunk, a smith's ingot, heated and cooled, bent and straightened. When he was in the water, every heartbeat seemed a year. When he was out, the sun seemed to dip and rise like a skimmed stone. Even though his will was strong,
Vali couldn't help but take rests. At first, they untied him when he did so. Eventually, they did not. He could say, "Put me back in the water," but he couldn't make his body allow it. And the more times he went in, the harder he struggled. At first, he could control himself until he reached the center of the mire. After a day, he began to fight as they led him to the edge. It was a place of horror to him now, though no visions came, no insight or revelation, just the awful black water closing in on him, the pressures from within as the air struggled to burst from his lungs, and without as the water rushed to get in. A weighty black mass seemed to pull at his brain, heavier on the left than the right, the asymmetry giving him a headache like he had never known. His throat was raw, and he could hardly speak. There was no crowd there to see the magic. The Danes had gone, and the Rygir were at home, sitting in groups remembering the dead, tending the wounded, or just keeping their children close and the door shut. Adisla was the only one taken, but 10 others had died, and still more were wounded. People drank, though not in celebration, hoping to damp down the misery and accentuate the glory of the violent day. Only Yodis's children and Bragi came to watch Vali suffer. Yodis sent her girl away to bring soup, but Vali couldn't drink it. His throat had clamped shut, so he shivered out the interludes between his ordeals, starving and cold. On the first day he managed 12 trips to the water. On the second, he did 4. The third day, lack of sleep blunting the reality of what he was doing, he managed 8. And towards the evening, he did begin to see. Drowning beneath the dark waters, he was somewhere else other than the mire, somewhere equally cold, but not wet or dark. At that turning point, the moment between the panic and the calm of drowning, he was in a confined space, a tunnel that seemed to glow, the rocks emitting a soft and alien light. Someone was there, he was sure, though he couldn't say who. He could feel their presence as a tone, a mood, or a pattern of thought. He had never known anything like it. It was a mind that seemed like a river, always moving, always the same. And, like a river, it had currents that might drag you down. And when he was lifted from the water, he didn't see Ori and Hongni, but that strange red-haired man in the cloak of hawk feathers, taking him up and out into the clean, cold air. He heard a voice that seemed familiar. "Give yourself completely." Then the man was gone, and Vali could stand it no more. He knew what was required. You cannot go to the gates of death if you are still looking back at life. He needed to step forward boldly. The idea didn't come to him in words, but as a feeling of want, like a prisoner wants freedom. He was fettered by something, and the fetters needed to break. The men pulled him up, and he lay back in their arms, limp as pondweed.
"Lord," said Ori, "you have tried. There is nothing there for you."
"No," said Vali,
though the word was more of a cough than anything understandable. The men started towards the bank.
"No!"
They stopped.
"What, Lord?"
Vali made himself speak, forcing his aching lungs to expel the air through the constriction of his throat to frame the words. He was weak and tired, and he needed to end this suffering, whatever the cost. From behind the hillside, towards the sea, there came the sound of horns and a clamour. Forkbeard was returning. It meant nothing to Vali.
"Do not pull me out,"
he said.
"You mean to die?"
"The water,"
said Vali, pointing into the mire. He was beyond explanation. The sky was a cave, black with rain. the light unnatural, a subterranean glow like that tunnel. His senses seemed muted and dull, as if the darkness of the mire still clung to him. "You are raving, Lord," said Hongni. "Mar Yodis, the prince says we are to put him in again." Yodis tapped the ground with her foot in thought. She looked back over her shoulder in the direction of the sea, thinking of the girl on the Danish ship. Of course, the prince would be taken out of the mire, but perhaps it was time to give it longer. Much longer.
"Do as he says," she said.
Now it was Hongni and Ori who hesitated, but Vali took the decision from their hands. With the last of his strength, he kicked his feet away from under him and cast himself back into the water. Chapter 22 Magical Thinking. The Witch Queen was working on the moon sword when she realized that the sorcerer had found Vali. She had taken Orthon's weapon on an impulse, not a whim like an ordinary human might have, but in response to a magical feeling. She knew it was important, and in the years since the king had come to the cave, she had realized how. The wolf would kill Odin, but then it would need to die. Ancient prophecy was clear on how this would happen. Odin would fall, and then another, kinder, more humane god would kill the wolf. If the pre-echo of that conflict really was to be played out in her lifetime, then that god would need a weapon. The wolf could not be killed by any normal blade, otherwise it would not be able to defeat the king of gods in battle. So the sword would need to be enchanted. In the lower caves there was a narrow wedge of rock where the jagged ceiling met an uneven floor. She had always thought it looked like the jaws of a wolf. Now she wedged the sword into it, as the sword was wedged into the jaws of the Fenris wolf, and for months she concentrated on seeing it as something that could harm the savage god. The witch was so strong in magic that she was half a god herself, and her perceptions were not like those of humans, things that flicker into being for an instant and then cease to exist when attention shifts. They were more like living things, spider thoughts that crawled from the egg of her mind over the object of her meditation, the sword, and waited to ensnare whatever encountered the weapon in future. She convinced herself that the weapon would kill the wolf, and the sisters sat with her, sharing that belief. At the end of their period of meditation, that idea had entered the moon sword, and would warp the perceptions of all who encountered it in future, including the wolf himself. Gulveig knew that anything that could defeat Odin would not be killed by a lesser magic, and all magics were less than that possessed by the king of gods. But she saw one hope. The prince, she knew, had been raised on tales of his father's battles, and had grown up hearing stories of the magical lost sword. When he was eaten by the wolf, his consciousness would mingle with his brother's. That, she believed, provided the key to the wolf's death. The magic would not need to batter down the wolf's defenses. It would enter through a crack provided by the man who had given his life to bring the Fenris wolf to earth. The meditation was finishing when the witches felt a brief pause in the flow of things, like someone sleeping in a cart might suddenly become aware that it had stopped. Vali, in the mire, had stepped into the magic space of visions and prophecy where the witches lived, and it was as if they had heard his footfalls at its threshold. The witch queen was aware of someone else, too. She heard chanting and drums, and saw the eyes of the sorcerer. Then she felt the delicious pull of cold waters, felt her throat constricting, the desperation for air, a thick despair in her head, and she fell into Vali's mind. She had known before that male magic was weak. The rituals that the wolf shaman Kveld Ulf practiced, for instance, could influence the physical realm, but were scarcely recognizable as magic at all to the sisters of the Troll Wall. They were performed without the aid or understanding of the runes, and to the Witch Queen were as strong as a house built without foundations. The blue-eyed sorcerer's presence was almost fragile to her. She saw images pulsing from his drum, running wolves, reindeer, bears, all moving from the skin as little stick figures, dancing their way into the mire. What was he trying to do? She allowed herself to sink into the rhythm of the drum, turning it over in her head. After a time, she understood it, owned it. The rhythm was hers to command now. The sorcerer was concentrating too much on the man in the mire and didn't realize she was there, that the beat coming from his drum had been altered and was spilling his secrets into the web of the Witch Queen's mind. His thoughts fell open to her. He had been seeking the twin who had become a prince, had insight into his importance, but had no real idea how to proceed, she could tell. The Witch Queen was pleased. She had her enemy at her mercy, distracted, not aware of her, his limited magic ensnared in an attempt to influence the young man in the mire. She felt the runes rising in her as a sharp thorn to prick him with, fire to burn him, ice to freeze him, water or earth to stop up his breath. In the darkness of her cave, she felt a hand take hers. She turned in the weak glow of a whale-fat candle to see a woman with a ruined face sitting beside her, smiling. Then a realization came to the witch's mind, and she forgot her odd companion. The witch knew that the sorcerer, no matter how weak he appeared, was the god Odin. Therefore, any vulnerability he expressed was a strength in disguise. She might attack him, but he would survive, and in surviving, he might realize who he was, awake to his powers, and crush her. The candle guttered, and the shadows seemed to stretch across her sight as she sensed her murder-minded ancestors looking at her from the rocks around her. In their sudden presence was a message she knew. Magical thinking can appear close to insanity, but, like some forms of insanity, it has aspects of genius. The first witches had known Odin had taken up female magic. He alone among men was a master of the women's art, Seid, as it was called. Loki had told Gullveig that the god was lore-jealous, that he was striking at her because she had become too wise in magic. So the god hated powerful sorcerers in the earthly realm, and would come to kill them. Very good, she thought. Then if the god himself came to the earthly realm and was made to recognize himself as the most powerful sorcerer, he would strike at himself. The god could be tricked into killing his own incarnation. Odin was known as the all-hater. Would he exempt himself from that hate? No. She would help the sorcerer, strengthen him and weaken herself, and in so doing she would shrink from the notice of the dead god and make him focus his attention on his own earthly self. He had seen enough to embark on that path anyway, she could tell. His visions had shown him the wolf and the boys, and now he was trying to summon the creature to be his protector. He was using the girl. The Wolfsangel showed the witch that the healer's girl was bound to the brothers and to their eventual transformation. So Gullveig's enemy had nearly everything in place to summon the wolf. And yet, without her help, he would never do it. The death of the girls in the witch caves had not been an attack. It had been a sort of prophecy, guidance, even perhaps a manifestation of her own magic, telling her what to do. The keys to magic, the witches had always known, were pain and shock. Now she saw the key to survival was weakness. She would diminish the power of her sisterhood, bolster that of her enemy, and help him perform the magic that would destroy him. She had thought that she would call the wolf to destroy the god. Now she knew better. The god could call the wolf himself. The sorcerer had achieved a great deal without the runes. With them, she thought, he would rush to his fate. Gullveig decided she would send her enemy a gift. One of the older sisters, the one who held the rune that shone like a lamp in the dark and brought insight and clarity to the witch's visions, was dying, lying in the upper caves. Her inheritor was at her feet, deep in the trance that would enable her to receive the rune. That, thought Gullveig, could not happen. Disa had been right about magic. A spell is not a recipe as such, though many have their ingredients, their methods of mixing and baking in the dark oven of the mind. It is more like a puzzle, where constituent parts must first be identified and then assembled into a whole, or even like embroidery, but formed from pain and denial rather than needle and thread. At its higher reaches, magic is a matter of feel. The witch queen, who had trained her instincts in years in the dark, knew that cold thought yielded nothing in sorcery. The way to achieve what she wanted was simply to begin, to take those invisible threads in her hands, the one called agony, the one called despair, and weave them into something more than the sum of their parts. As she allowed herself to fall into a trance, Gullveig thought of the dying witch, and her breathing became shallow, her limbs feeling weak in sympathy. Rot was in the witch queen's mind. Disease, the burst corpses of fever victims, the stink on the breath of old women dying. The smell seemed to cling to the witch queen, and she knew that the old witch's was a rightful death, a fine and beautiful thing. The witch queen walked with the woman through her deathbed memories. She saw how the old witch had been brought to the caves as a girl, felt her fear of the darkness, her anguish as she was trained, and her elation as the rune finally lit up in her and bonded her fast to her sisters. She sensed the other witches too, spectral presences in the old woman's mind, and she went to them, telling them it was time to leave and to bid their sister goodbye. The witches melted away, and the queen felt the dying woman's thoughts shriveling in on themselves. When the sisters were gone, Gullveig sat with her in the dimness of her mind. Her rune was shining in the murk, like a lantern. Gullveig took it, and the witch died. She saw the girl who was to receive it waiting in the dark. In her trance, the witch queen held up her hand, and the girl fell dead. Then she returned to Vali in the mire and sent it spinning towards the sorcerer. She heard a cry, heard the rhythm of the drums falter as the rune entered him. The witch smiled to herself. Now he would have insight and clarity like he had never had before. He would understand what to do when she sent him the next rune. She took out her small piece of leather, ran her thumb around the outline of the Wolfsangel rune. The sorcerer could sense her now, she could tell. She thought of the Wolfsangel, and opened her consciousness like a deadly flower, exposing the dark nectar of the rune within. Something reached hungrily into her head, tearing and ripping. The witch fought to stop herself retaliating, to keep her defenses down. Her eyes felt as though they would burst, as the sorcerer's drumbeat seemed to chisel the rune from inside her. She fell forward, bleeding at the nose and at the mouth, biting at her fingers to try to distract herself from the pain in her head. She felt her enemy's exultation and agony as the rune wound its tendrils into his mind. The witch was satisfied. The god's manifestation was on the way to where he needed to be to destroy himself. Now he really could call the wolf, which meant he would die. She withdrew from her trance and shivered. The experience of having killed one of her own buzzed through her mind like an angry wasp through a summer's day.
She had stepped deeper into insanity, but even that felt right. She got up to go to her dead sister. She would sit with her a while, she thought. It would be useful to confront what she had done, feel its impact, stroke the old witch's hair, stay with her in the darkness while she rotted. Murder, regret, and grief were tools she could work with to dig new tunnels through the labyrinth of her magical mind. She stood, not noticing the hand that helped her to her feet. Chapter 23 Running Wolf. To Vali, the panic seemed dimmer this time, smudged by tiredness. His endurance was gone, and he breathed in, then felt the clamping of his throat, the involuntary spasm of the muscles as he tried to propel himself to the surface. He tried to relax, to let what had to happen happen. Then the fear fell away from him, disappearing like a ballast stone dropped from a ship. "He's still," said Hongni. Ori just shook his head and looked down. The rain had set in properly, unrelenting sheets sweeping off the ocean. The whole world seemed made of water, the mire and the hillside that held it just smears of grey against a storm-black sky. Vali felt the certainty of death, calm and comforting, bringing with it the promise of an end to cares. Death felt like a warm bed he could climb into, like meat to the hungry. There were entities in his mind, hostile presences, he thought. He felt displaced in his own consciousness, a tenant in his own head. There was a man. His presence felt fragile, and he was fighting a woman whose mind seemed as deep and dangerous as the ocean. But the man was winning. He had taken something from the woman. Vali's normal senses and thoughts could not understand what that thing was. It came to him as a shape, a cut in things, a cut in everything, a jagged slash in the fabric of creation. Vali was in that tunnel again, the glow of the rocks like light through water, the air cold and heavy. The floor was flooded up to his knees. He looked to his side and saw a strange figure. It was a man in a stiff wolf mask, something constructed of wood and fur. In his hand was a shallow drum. "Why am I here?" Vali's voice sounded curiously muted. The man in the mask began to beat the drum. Vali instinctively understood it was intended to summon something, something within him. The light seemed to ripple, and he became aware of the shape again. It seemed to tremble from the skin of the drum, to hover, shake, and pulse in front of his eyes. Destinies, he knew, were set at birth. The future was a path between mountains, and you could not deviate from it. The legend of the Norns, the three women who sit beneath the world tree spinning out the fate of each human, had been impressed upon him since his earliest years. But now, something was being offered to him. That shape, that awful, awful shape, something between a knife and a needle, to cut the thread of his life and restitch it. Something hooked and sharp, yet incorporeal. An idea more than a thing. The strange shape was a disturbance in the world that caused other disturbances. It was a rune. He could not see it now, but the thought of it seemed to float at the edge of his consciousness, like an idea remembered from a dream. The rhythm of the drum seemed to command Vali, and he had the strong urge to lie down in the water of the tunnel. He gave into it, leaning back and stretching out his arms, bending back his legs, and sticking his head forward. Vali's body contorted into the shape that seemed to capture his whole being, his whole destiny. The Wolfsangel. He now seemed just an expression of its meaning.
He understood that he was being offered a choice. This shape, or no shape, the rune, or death. And then, in his mind, he wasn't the rune at all. He stood. The rune was the wolf man he had captured in the hills.